This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. As children, many of us were enchanted by ghost stories and tales of the supernatural that featured communication from beyond the grave or flying saucers. And we imagined what it would be like to read other people's minds or move objects with our thoughts. But as we grow older, we put away things of childish imagination and stick with what we know, the cold, hard facts. Of course, there are some adults who still take such things seriously. Steve Volk is one of them, and he thinks we need to invest a little more effort in investigating paranormal experience. He's worked for years as a reporter in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh covering normal topics like crime and education, but lurking in his memory was the recollection of something spooky that happened when he was a kid, something that sounded an awful lot like the movie Poltergeist. It set Steve on a journey to investigate the unexplained. Steve Volk is the author of the book Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. The Ryan Research Center is hosting a talk with him tomorrow night at Stedman Auditorium on the Duke Center for Living campus. But first, he joins us from WXPN Studio in Philadelphia. Steve Volk, welcome.
Thanks for that generous introduction, Frank.
My pleasure. The catalyst for this book, now this haunting that happened to you when you were a kid, what happened?
Well, it happened when I was around 5, 6 years old, and so all my memories of it are untrustworthy. That's one of the sort of intriguing things about it, is that I have these memories of it, but we know that childhood memory is particularly fallible. So it's a story I kind of grew up with as a kid. I had my own memories of it. My parents told the story to me. My brothers and sisters shared the story with me, and it was truly outlandish, right? What would happen in the main was we would hear a strange noise in the middle of the night. It would only happen at night after everyone was asleep, and it would wake us out of bed. It was a thumping, booming sort of sound that to my brother and I in our room seemed to be coming from the roof over our heads, and to our sisters who did not share an adjoining wall with us on the other side of the house. It sounded like it was coming from up in the walls of their room. And my parents downstairs thought it was coming from probably the roof of the house, and it was so loud that it would wake them up all the way downstairs. And it was a pretty sizable house. So for a while, they did, I think, what you would expect most people to do. They ignored it. But over time, it went on so long, and they were getting woken up out of bed so much that they started to try and investigate it. And during this period, there were also stories that my sisters would tell that were far more outlandish still. They would claim that their blankets were pulled from their beds, that they saw an old woman walk through the room, and that their bed shook at night, and as if somebody was like grabbing the bedposts and twisting them left and right.
Now, let me stop you there. Were they telling those stories to you, or were they also telling them to your parents?
Also to my parents.
Yeah.
And I can remember actually them waking up shrieking and waking me up. And my parents would come running upstairs, and it would be, you know, like all the drama you could imagine. But, you know, my parents, being skeptical themselves, kind of set those stories aside. They didn't know what to do about them. Years later, my father told me when I was an adult, he said, well, you know, who wants to think that they're being haunted? I've found that some people do want to think they're being haunted, but my parents weren't among them.
Well, how did it end? How did it end?
Well, the way it ended is after they had exhausted themselves trying to come up with some sort of mundane explanation, right? They one of them would go upstairs and try and make noises while the other one was downstairs and see if they could do anything that would mimic the sound we heard, right? After they did these sorts of things and had eliminated water hammers and plumbing problems and that sort of stuff as anything associated with the problem, they eventually decided, you know, maybe we do have some kind of ghost here. So we were practicing Catholics at the time. My dad told the family priest, and one of the parts of the story I really love is the priest said, you know, usually in cases like this, what I do is I just come over and bless the house. And of course, what I love about that is the idea that it happened so much that he had a protocol for it, right? He comes over, and I still remember this, him praying in Latin and throwing holy water in the corners and swinging like an incense burner around. And he left. And when he left, he said to my dad, you know, so long, Jerry, I'm sure everything will be fine. The thing is, everything wasn't fine that night. Mm. In fact, it was worse than ever. The sound went on longer and louder. We all ran downstairs. My parents were prepared to leave for the night, you know, just to let this thing, whatever it was, right, whatever's going on, to cool out. And then the noise did something it never did before. It came down the stairs and it hit them one step at a time till it got to the very, very bottom. And it hit that bottom floor with a great big crash. And that was it. We never heard it again.
Wow. Did when this was happening, were you all comparing notes? Were you saying, did you hear what I heard? Yeah, it came down the stairs. Yeah.
Well, you have to remember, me being 5 or 6, yeah. I think what I did was hid behind my parents' legs. But, you know, the rest of the family tells me that, yeah, they very much did compare notes.
So you would think an experience like this would prepare – would launch you into a career of investigating the paranormal. But in fact, it ended that night and you went on to have a career as a reporter. And it wasn't until later on that you looked back. And tell us about that. What caused you to look back and now write this book?
You know, when my mom died, I think that that's a life-shifting event for a lot of people when a parent dies. And it had me asking all the sort of big existential questions. And that story, you know, just leapt to mind as something that indicated maybe we're more than meatballs, right? Like maybe we're more than, as Jerry Coyne recently put it in USA Today, we're more than – he says we're meat computers, right? So maybe we're more than meat computers. And so I thought, you know, these stories carry a lot of stigma with them. It's one of the reasons I stopped telling the story over the years. And that itself seemed a little silly to me. I mean, once I started looking at the poll numbers on the subject, you know, around 20% of us believe we've directly experienced some sort of ghost. And 40% of us believe we've had some kind of telepathic experience. And around 20% think they've seen a UFO. And I thought, you know, if this many people are reporting this experience, whether it's true or not, right, whether or not how we define it is correct, we need to take it seriously and not, you know, ridicule people or mock people for it, but really take a good, honest look at it. And so between that sort of – I had personal and public motivations then, you know, and so I sallied forth, as it were, and I ventured into the world of the paranormal.
Well, I want to take a look at some of those stories in detail and what it might tell us about perhaps the paranormal, what else is out there or not, if we were to take the study more seriously, and at the very least, what it tells us about consciousness. The book Fringeology, the author Steve Volk, my guest this hour on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today with Steve Volk, the author of the book Fringeology. And Steve, we were talking about sort of the experience that you had as a young man. You went on to have a career as a reporter. We can talk a little more about that later, but I want to get at some of the stories that you investigate in the book. You talk about a lot of different things people can't explain. But let's talk about the town, the entire town that experienced some kind of UFO sightings and how they dealt with it. Tell us that story.
Yeah, I went to Stephenville, Texas, where they had one of the most intriguing UFO sightings probably in the history of the phenomenon. And when I say UFO, I want people to understand that I really do mean unidentified flying object, right? It means we don't know what it was. If we're defining it as an alien craft, you know, we need to have some sort of direct evidence of that, and then it would no longer be a UFO. Same thing if it was a weather balloon, right, or a meteor or something like that. It would no longer be a UFO. So this is a case that I consider still unresolved. And the people there had, in January 2008, the great misfortune, as I like to put it, of looking up. And what they saw there was a series of lights in the sky that seemed to be connected. They had a kind of rectangular shape to them. And if they were part of one craft, it was a massive craft. It could move at incredible speeds, faster than the F-16s that they were used to seeing in the area, because there's a very nearby a military base there. It could move a lot faster than those F-16s. And in fact, some of the witnesses saw F-16s in a trail position on the thing, on the object, right? And what really intrigued me about it, though, is that MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network that investigates these sorts of things, had flown into action on this one. And they hit town and they filed some Freedom of Information Act requests. And as a reporter, I had a lot of respect for that. They sought radar data right away. And they did find, after going through the radar data, that there was something in the sky that did seem to be operating in the with no transponder, that seemed to be operating in this general direction and moving at sort of the appropriate speeds that some of the witnesses had put the object at. And so I went to Stephenville to check out how they were doing, and it turned out that I was the last person on Earth they wanted to see. Mm. And this was about a year after the signing, I guess, year and a half. They were
Why is that? I mean, because they had people had come to them, right? I mean, the town, it made news.
You know, I come up with a blanket term in fringeology for people who've experienced something that, you know, people consider paranormal, and I call them embarrassed Americans, right? And that's what I think the people of Stephenville were. They were sort of stung by the publicity they received. And, you know, you're talking about literally here a small town in Texas.
And about how many people? Town. How many people are we talking about? Who had
about 17,000?
Not
17,000 witnesses. No.
But how many on the record is saying I saw something? Don't know what it is.
You know, with me, there were about 9 people I was able to talk to directly in the 5 days I was there.
And they don't want to see you because people have already, you know, called them crazy, right?
Yeah, and so MUFON gathered dozens of witnesses, and because in the initial investigation, people were actually more willing to talk than they were a year and a half later because they weren't really wounded yet.
Right.
So you're talking about a literal cow town here. It's a they call themselves the cowboy capital of America. And so it just sort of fit the cliche that people have about people who see UFOs being unsophisticated. And they were really offended. And I have to say I can understand why, because they struck me as very, very credible. And they're people who are saying they saw something they couldn't explain. And I don't really see where the shame is in that. In fact, I see it as a fascinating point of curiosity and a fun story.
The problem is when you use the term UFO, which is unidentified flying object, immediately the mind goes to alien.
Yep.
And so what happens in my mind? I say, well, I don't believe in life outside of the Earth. So therefore, you didn't see it. I mean, that seems to be our thought process. And that's the thought process that you really attack in your book.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we form a worldview, all of us. And it either includes alien craft, right, or it doesn't. I mean, some of us might just be a little more open-minded about it. But in general, we all form a worldview and we decide what's in and what's out. And when somebody comes along claiming that something is in that we had considered impossible, our first knee-jerk reaction, and it's an emotional one, is to just reject what they're saying out of hand. And I think that that's kind of what happens way too often in regard to the paranormal. When something gets that – what I call the paranormal taint on it, there's a certain subsection of people – self-identified skeptics oftentimes who take it on as their mission to argue it out of existence rather than explore what's really being reported here.
And it's not necessarily an alien spacecraft. It's unidentified. Don't know what it is, right?
Right.
So, if we drop the investigation, you know, because you think there's no life from outer space, we don't know who sent that thing or what it was. And it stays unidentified, and that's curious to me.
I found it very fascinating that in regards to Stephenville, very near a military operating area, right, where people are used to seeing military craft, the preferred skeptical explanation is a flare drop. But if you talk to, as put forth by James McGahey from the Skeptical Inquirer and that sort of whole crew related to James Randi, if anybody knows about Randi, and he said it was a flare drop. Now, I'm not here arguing for or against aliens, but I will argue all day long that it wasn't a flare drop.
And a flare drop is what?
Well, military craft, jets dropping flares to test a new set of flares that the military was developing. That's That's the argument that comes from the skeptics. But if you listen to what the witnesses said, these are people who see flare drops.
Right.
And flares behave in particular ways. They move with the wind. They don't fly faster than the jets that are supposedly dropping them. They don't cover ground from one side of the horizon to the other for many, many miles. Flares don't do that, period. Flares, I think, are really easy to rule out if you just listen to the witnesses at all. But what intrigues me is that there's another possible, you know, more mundane or earthbound explanation that you would think, you know, that somebody with a skeptical mind would put forth, right? Which is that, well, maybe there was some kind of test craft, right? Maybe there was some sort of military craft in the area that people weren't used to that does move at speeds faster even than an F-16.
Well, and that the military is not going to tell you about yet.
Right. Right.
I mean, that's the thing about skepticism. It really means to keep an open mind until you actually find the answer and not just posit a possible alternative and say, and I think my possible alternative is better than yours, therefore I'm a skeptic.
Well, you know what they'll do too, exactly. They'll make an argument like, well, we know that flares exist. We don't know that aliens exist. Therefore, right off the bat, my explanation is better than yours.
Yeah.
And I could theoretically make the same claim about, you know, military test craft. We know the military test crafts. Therefore, that explanation is better than aliens. I'm not even doing that. I'm just trying to use that argument to show how skeptics, it seems to me, want to find the most demeaning argument possible to deflate their who they see as sort of their opponent, right?
You have a chapter in the book about the famous psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Tell us about her and about the work she's mostly known for.
You know, that chapter was really, really gratifying and challenging for me and emotional. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, I reread her masterwork on death and dying while my mom was sick with cancer. And I had read it before in school and I read it again then. And Kubler-Ross worked in the 60s in Chicago, and she was the first psychologist to really sit with the terminally ill and listen to what they had to say. The common practice in Western medicine was to oftentimes not even inform the terminally ill of their condition. The idea was it was too awful to tell them, so you just didn't say it, and you kind of figured, you know, well, that's the elephant in the room. Either they get it or they don't, and we're not going to tell them.
Yeah.
And Kubler-Ross walked into this situation and said, hey, wait a second, you know, something's really unhealthy, really wrong here. And she started going to the terminally ill, telling them of their condition, and writing down what they had to say and seeing what that experience is like for them and how the hospital staff might be able to interact with them in a way that would make what is clearly, you know, the most horrifying and painful time in someone's life as tolerable as possible.
Yeah, and she's famous for her book on death and dying, which has changed a lot of the ways we think about death in those final stages. Famous for that. But the original book on death and dying included a chapter about near-death experiences, right?
Yeah. So Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, when she was sitting with the dying, didn't just hear stories about how they were suffering psychologically or how they wanted to patch things up with loved ones before they died. She also heard these stories that initially blew her mind. And I spoke to her research partner, Mwalimu Amara, a reverend, who was very, very generous with his time. And he had been alongside her for most of this research and did a lot of it on his own too. And they initially ignored these stories, right? They would hear stories about people who claimed to have left their bodies while they were being resuscitated, who saw their bodies from a distance, who were able to describe the resuscitation procedures, you know, seemingly accurately. And their first take on this was no, you know. Their first take on this was to not write notes during that particular section of the interviews they were doing with these patients. This was before the phrase near-death experience had even been coined, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is the mid-60s, and that phrase didn't even come along until 1975. So there was no public awareness that such a thing was even possible. But the thing is, she kept hearing these stories so often, and so did Reverend Amara, that finally they decided, you know, if our job here is to catalog the experiences of the dying, this is one of them. And what really motivated them to do it was noticing that the people who had had a near-death experience seemed much more at peace with their health condition, right, with their terminal illness, than the people who hadn't.
And these are people, the near-death experience, we really haven't described it, but this is, I think we've heard about these, where people feel like they're being drawn into some other realm. They may see a bright light. It's a real sense of having been taken some other place and then returned.
Yeah, and the standard, you know, the standard version is, yeah, you know, their heart stops beating or whatever it might be, or they're in some moment of grave danger, and they leave their body, they see their body from above, they visit another realm, visit with deceased relatives oftentimes, or some sort of, you know, spirit being. And believe me, like, look, I'm a city reporter. I can't even believe I'm in this territory, right? But but here we are, because there's a tremendous number of people who report the experience. So she started writing, taking notes on all this. And by the time she was contracted to write on death and dying, she'd accumulated enough of these experiences that she wrote an entire chapter on near-death experiences and was ready to send it in the next day to her publisher. But she had a final meeting with Reverend Amara, and I describe it at length in the book, where they sat up late at night, and the most important conversation they needed to have was, what about this chapter? Are we going to include it? And Reverend Amara talked her out of including it, because the people that needed them the most, the terminally ill, could find their needs and their situation undercut by this. Paranormal claims are so tainted that if she had said that, you know, people are reporting this, even if she didn't define herself as believing their accounts, it was just so taboo that it could have destroyed all of her research. And frankly, I believe it would have. I believe that her book would have gone, you know, almost nowhere if she had put that in it.
What did it do to her personally?
Well, personally, it changed her fundamentally, and the precipitating incident, really sort of to her fall, is that in 1975, Raymond Moody comes along and contacts her, apparently not knowing that her patients had reported these sorts of experiences, because he's getting ready to write a book about what he is now calling near-death experiences. And so she agrees to write the foreword to it and says, though I don't remember the exact language, that my patients that I interview tell me similar stories. And I think that this guy's done a good job of cataloging what it is they have to say. Well, she had so much credibility at this point. You're talking about an international superstar associated not just with psychology, really, but science, you know, with the idea that if we sit and look at something rationally, we're going to come to better conclusions than if we react emotionally or out of superstition. And she had really diagnosed the entire – all of Western medicine as treating death almost superstitiously. They dared not speak its name. And now here she was advocating for the idea that people are having experiences at and around the time of death, which suggests that maybe death isn't the end. So her reputation took a massive hit. And for the rest of her life, she seemingly sought proof, something that would be so compelling to people that they could not deny that there's more to us than meatballs, to pick up the thread from, you know, from the previous segment, right?
Well, I tell you what, let's leave the conversation right there. We'll pick it up after this break. Steve Volk, author of Fringeology. Ryan Center is hosting a talk with him tomorrow night at the Stedman Auditorium on the Duke Center for Living campus. Our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today to Steve Volk. He is the author of the book Fringeology. Steve, I want to talk about, you know, you talked about Elizabeth Kubler-Ross just before this and sort of her career unraveling, her being discredited because she wanted to demonstrate the possibility of an afterlife. When you foreclose on this line of reasoning, what's the impact? And I think maybe it's illustrated best in the section that where you talk about Stuart Hameroff, the anesthesiologist who worked with a physicist Roger Penrose, and they talked about quantum consciousness. Give us a sense of what they were looking for.
Well, a couple of things here, just to backtrack for one second. I mean, I think if we ignore these topics, if we were to brush aside the near-death experience, there's a couple levels on which I think we lose, right? The first level is in terms of the big existential questions, you know, and one of them obviously is what happens when we die? And we don't know the answer to that. There are a lot of people who are walking around saying that we do, you know, on one side or the other. But the fact is that we don't. It's impossible to measure what happens to a person's consciousness after the moment of death. And so I think it's important to recognize that I think the first thing we lose is sort of a sense of humility and a sense of the mystery that really is our existence and is most fundamental to our existence, which is the nature of our consciousness and does it survive beyond death. So that's the first thing. But the second thing we lose, and it's something I hope that the more skeptical sort of listeners out there can get on board with, is that these experiences potentially, and a lot of these paranormal experiences are this way that I address in the book. These experiences say something about what it means to be conscious at all, what the powers associated with having consciousness are, how these sorts of profound experiences can affect us going forward in the rest of our lives. If you don't mind my digressing for a moment, I have a chapter in here on lucid dreaming in which I discovered for myself in the writing process, based off of a lucid dream I had that helped me deal with the anxiety over writing an entire book. Right?
Lucid dreaming, you know, is when you're aware of the fact that you're dreaming.
And you're dreaming.
While you're dreaming.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's a system where you by which you make yourself aware. So it doesn't just happen. You're actually more or less in control of that.
Yeah. So I had an experience of that, and that's a conscious experience, right? You now have this awareness of the dream that makes the dream much more vivid and intense and allows you to choose your own actions within the dream. I had a dream that helped me deal with my anxiety around writing the book. And I have to tell you, Frank, when I sat down to write, I was writing a minimum of 5,000 words a day, which outstrips my normal production by more than three times. A good day, I usually write 1,500 words. I wrote 7,000 or 8,000 words most of the time. That's what I averaged. And there were days when I wrote as many as 15,000 words. And it was because I had a dream that gave me confidence that I was going to be able to write this book. In fact, what I was told in the dream is that the book was already written, that all I was going to do was live through the process of what has already been done, in a sense, right? Very, very loopy sort of mind game, right? That dream gave me, but it really worked for me. And so let's take this back to what you originally asked about Penrose and Hameroff. What I think they're ultimately exposing is that consciousness is the most fundamental mystery that remains, and the most fundamental mystery of human existence. There is simply an explanatory gap between chemical impulses and electrical excitations at the level of the neuron, which are very much physical events, and the decidedly non-physical realm of subjective experience and thought. In other words, consciousness. And that gap has not been closed. And a lot of very, very serious, highly regarded philosophers and scientists have grave doubts that it ever will be.
Is it because of skepticism over this? I mean, are these worlds coming together now? Are we realizing that things that were irrational and perhaps out of our grasp are now worth the study?
I think we might be getting a little closer in that regard, right, where people are at least willing to acknowledge that there's some reason to study it. Mm-hmm. I think that people, however, are committed to very specific conclusions still. You know, it's worth studying, but we know it's going to come out that there is no afterlife, or, yeah, it's worth studying, but of course we already know that, you know, if we're not right with Jesus, it's not going to work out for us in the afterlife. There are a lot of people still committed to those sorts of endings, I think. But what I believe we need to do going forward, and what the whole sort of the whole shape phrenology takes is built around this, is just drawing a distinction between what we know and what we believe, you know? And when we know something, we need to have evidence enough for it. That's what it means to me. Evidence enough for it that it can be a kind of shared knowledge that we pass from person to person. And we don't have that kind of knowledge yet when it comes to what happens when we die, whether or not there's a God, alien life, all these sorts of things.
Steve, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Steve Voke is the author of the book Phrenology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. The Ryan Research Center is hosting a talk with him tomorrow night at the Stedman Auditorium on the Duke Center for Living campus at 7:30 p.m.